¿Evolucionará el ser humano hacia el...
You should be set to take it out, yeah.
Can I please ask everybody to take their seats now because we are going to start with our session. The 12th meeting of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, today we shall take up item 7 of the agenda, future work of the Permanent Forum, including issues of the Economic and Social Council and emerging issues. This morning, we will start with a panel on the impact of the financial and economic crisis on indigenous peoples. I would like to acknowledge the presence of our panelists. In the list of our panelists earlier, we wanted to have the representative of the World Bank, but we were informed yesterday that they hadn't found anybody, so we are reduced to 3 panelists. But we are very fortunate to have with us today Mr. Jomo Sundaram, the Assistant Secretary General of the Department of Economic and Social Affairs, Mr. Nicolas Lucas Ticum of Guatemala, who is a sacerdote Maya, who is a Maya priest and a researcher on the Calendario Maya. And I will also be part of this panel. We decided in the forum that we put an issue related to the impact of the global economic crisis on indigenous peoples, because this is the issue that is being discussed by many UN agencies as well as the General Assembly of the United Nations. Last March, they had a meeting on this issue. The Commission on Social Development also addressed this issue, and we know for a fact that indigenous peoples all over the world are affected by this global economic crisis, even if it started here in the United States. You know, we are such a globalized economy that when the United States sneezes, as they say, the whole world gets pneumonia. No, so we have to really look at this issue to see how it affects us. And we are, as I mentioned earlier, Jomo Sundaram will be our key expert on this issue. He is an economist. I have known him for some time, and he has really been a very good researcher and has written a lot of books on the economic crisis. And so we are fortunate to have him. He has asked me to tell the audience that he has to leave by 10:55 because he has to launch a new publication of the Department of Economic and Social Affairs. So without further ado, I would like to invite Mr. Sundaram to please give us the contribution he has on this issue, which is one of his expert areas. You have the floor, Mr. Sundaram.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. What I would like to do over the next few minutes is to share with you a brief presentation on the origins and the nature and the consequences of the current crisis. And I will conclude with a few remarks on how it may affect Indigenous peoples specifically. But Indigenous peoples are also working people, they are also parents, they are also children, and so much of the discussion will deal with the different aspects of life which we are all involved in. I think it is important to recognize that this was a crisis which was anticipated, particularly by the United Nations system. It comes from a number of problems, including the kinds of policies which have been pursued in the last three decades or so, policies which minimize regulation, which promoted so-called self-regulation and inappropriate regulation. We also find that these policies did not contribute to enhancing economic welfare, let alone growth and stability. And we also find that most developing countries, and of course the vast majority of people in the world, are really innocent victims in this whole situation. What we find, however, is that the responses have been very much dominated by the powerful countries in the world, and we see that they are very inadequate to the challenge at hand, and also involve double standards, which limit the possibility of developing countries responding more adequately to the crisis. Particularly, we find that the United Nations has a possibility of responding very strongly to this crisis, thanks to the leadership of the President of the General Assembly, Father Miguel Descoto, who has been providing very important leadership in trying to frame these issues rather differently than it is currently framed. I think it would be useful to begin to recognizing that this phenomenon, which has been very important over the last three decades, called globalization, has involved financial globalization much more than trade globalization. Financial globalization is represented by the upper blue line, and it has grown much more than trade integration, which is represented by the red line. It is also important to recognize that despite the increase of financial globalization, it has not contributed to increased growth, but rather it has actually resulted in lower growth due to the lower investments represented by the upper brown line, and the yellow line below represents the growth of investments across borders. Now, financial globalization has caused a lot of problems. We find that by opening up, you find that countries have lost funds rather than gained funds. We also found that the cost of funds has generally been lower, and there has been higher volatility as well as a lower economic growth and greater instability. There have been problems of short-term capital inflows, which I will not elaborate on right now. We also find that this crisis, as the Chair has reminded us, has spread through the financial sector. It has spread within what is called the real economy, but it has also spread from the financial sector to the real economy and back in very important ways involving interactive loops. All this has resulted in slower economic growth, or what economists refer to as a deflationary spiral, where asset price markets have been collapsing, external demand has collapsed, and depressed domestic demand, and this has also resulted in depressing domestic demand. The financial impacts on developing countries have been very significant. Stock markets, for example, which I suspect most of you are not directly involved with, have collapsed in many important ways. And this has very, very important consequences in many different ways. We also find that there has been a significant reversal of capital flows which might have gone to developing countries. This has dried up. And the costs of borrowing have become much higher, and all this is very important. Now, few of you might remember the situation in the late 1970s. At the end of the 1970s, we had a situation where developing countries continued to grow very rapidly, but the rich countries, especially in the West, both in North America as well as in Europe, experienced what was called stagflation, low economic growth as well as high inflation. However, the situation now is very different. what we find now is that the fates of the whole world are inextricably intertwined. And what you find is that developing countries are now experiencing a downturn represented by the red line, together with the developed countries represented by the blue line. And so our fates are all tied up in ways partly due to greater economic integration, or what has been called globalization. The next few graphs are basically showing you how it has affected developed countries, where growth has gone down. It's affecting developing countries, where growth is also going down. And we find that different parts of the world have been affected in very different ways. And what is likely to happen is a significant reduction in growth, particularly in the year 2009, compared with the earlier period. So if you compare with 2008 was not a good year, but especially comparing between 2004 and 2007, the decline is quite significant. The details for different parts of the world are captured here in this table, and I won't go over the table since we have very little time. Instead, I want to emphasize that in many ways, the fates of the different parts of the world are very closely intertwined. This year, we will find that over 100 countries will see their economies contract, and of these economies, 60 economies are developing countries. 33 are developed countries, and the balance of about 14 are economies in transition. This is a completely unprecedented situation within our lifetimes, since the 1930s. Okay, this is a very, very unprecedented situation. Now, the price of various commodities have fallen, the price of oil has fallen, and this, of course, means those of us who buy oil pay lower prices. Food prices have also declined a little bit since early last year, but they still remain high compared to the earlier period since the beginning of this decade. World trade is expected to collapse by about 10% this year. And there is consensus on this issue, which other organizations such as the WTO and OECD also agree on. Developing countries are experiencing the hit in terms of exports, represented by the green line, which is collapsing much, much more compared to the red line, which is for the OECD or the rich countries. All this will result in a reduction of what are sometimes referred to as the global imbalances. There's a disorderly unwinding of the global imbalances, but this will basically mean, it is basically a reflection of the collapse in trade. It's not the best way to resolve the problem of the global imbalances. The trade impacts, therefore, for developing countries in particular, is that their exports will decline. The terms of trade, meaning the prices developing countries are getting, will also decline. And trade surpluses will run down very, very quickly. The only silver lining has been the lower energy and food prices, which I mentioned earlier. Capital inflows will contract. The price of credit continues to go up, and aid flows continue to be very unreliable. And as we know, some countries have already cut the aid. Italy, for example, the soft window of the aid package for Italy has been cut from 450 million to 50 million. Okay, that gives you a sense of how much is being cut in different parts of the world. Now, the social impacts are very, very serious. The ILO expects that the number of working people who will be considered poor will increase by more than 200 million people. Unemployment, formal unemployment, will rise by over 50 million. And all these ILO projections were based on the IMF's estimate of November last year. Since then, the situation has got even worse. And so I think the estimates which I mentioned to you earlier are probably underestimates. Now, all this means that social spending by governments will be greatly at risk, and there is growing social unrest in different parts of the world. U.S. intelligence shares the consensus that the greatest security threat, not only to the world as a whole, but also to the United States, comes from this crisis. Not from terrorism or anything else, it comes from this crisis. Now, livelihoods are being threatened in different ways. there will living standards are declining, many livelihoods are very much affected, social protection is not being funded. Migrant workers, people who are working in other countries, as well as those who are working in the urban areas of their own countries, are all especially vulnerable for a variety of reasons. This prolonged slowdown in the world economy, which is anticipated, is likely to affect people in different ways, and especially it is expected to affect young people. Remittances are expected to decline, and extreme poverty is expected to worsen. Now, we have the possibility of working together in the world to try to bring about a strong economic recovery. Unfortunately, international cooperation is lacking. If there was greater cooperation and coordination, we could have the red line scenario. Unfortunately, with the uncoordinated situation, even if we have enough stimuli efforts, and that is not guaranteed, we will probably have the lower scenario, which is the black line scenario. All this is true not only for developing countries, but also for the developed countries, as well as economies in transition, and especially for the least developed countries represented by the graph in the bottom right-hand corner. Now, outputs and job recovery, we know from the past, when there's a recession, when there's an economic crisis, when there's a financial crisis, when things even begin to improve, jobs do not recover as quickly as we would like. And so we see that there has been a lag before in the 1991 crisis and another lag in the 2001 crisis. And as you can see, in the 2001 crisis, the lag was almost 50 months, which is basically 4 years. Okay, and this gives you a sense of how slow job recovery can be. What we also find is that the failure to act is also going to delay the likelihood of recovery. And we can see how many months this recovery is likely the failure to act is likely to affect recovery as captured by these two bar charts. Now, the failure to coordinate is a very serious problem in various different ways, and I just another table to reinforce the point which I've been making. Social spending is already low. It is only 11% of government budgets, especially in developing countries. Now, this is likely to be adversely affected because governments are going to be able to collect even less tax revenue than before. Now, the international responses have been disappointing. What we find that recently as a strong reinforcement and strengthening of the IMF, but the IMF basically deals with balance of payments problems. It does not help governments to be able to fund on a sustainable basis their ability to spend money to help their citizens. And this is a very major problem. The President of the General Assembly created a commission of experts which has already prepared its report. It's now available on the website of the President of the General Assembly. And as you know, in about 4 weeks' time, there will be a major conference here at the General Assembly, convened by the President of the General Assembly, on the crisis and how to respond and how to deal with the crisis, particularly the impact on developing countries. All this basically means that there is a serious possibility that if there is enough political will, people will act together to try to address the fundamental problems. But the likelihood of this is very slim. Part of the reason is that we do not learn lessons. We do not learn from history. It took 15 years between the Depression of 1929 before the Bretton Woods Agreement of 1944. Even though in Bretton Woods, the conference was held during the middle of World War II, 44 countries, including 28 developing countries, participated in that. It is that kind of effort which is badly needed, an effort for the international community to come together to sustain growth and development, to sustain employment creation, to sustain development. Unfortunately, the focus right now is simply on financial stability and what is needed to achieve financial stability. The UN can play an important role, but it requires the support of the world community in leading the reform process to ensure that it is comprehensive and systemic, to ensure that the outcome is developmental as well as inclusive. There are agencies within the United Nations right now who are trying to provide what is called a second opinion capacity, and we must ensure also that the Bretton Woods institutions in Washington are in line with the objectives of the United Nations, which has not necessarily been the case so far. I think it's important for us to recognize that what the challenges are for indigenous people are quite varied, because the indigenous people find themselves in various different situations. But the big challenge, I suspect, will be the challenge for a struggle for natural resources, a struggle over natural resources. And indigenous people are now the custodians of a wide variety of natural resources, land, water, and so on and so forth. But there will be increasing struggles to try to ensure greater private property rights, which will often be associated with large and powerful corporations. And this will pose very, very serious threats to the livelihoods of people in indigenous communities, especially those who are still residing within their own indigenous communities. This will be a very, very major challenge. As we know, there are growing problems over water, partly associated with climate change. There are huge problems with food agriculture, and there will be a struggle for land. More and more people who will want to try to get access to arable land, and this will pose a huge problem. Water is now becoming a commodity which is traded, which is sold. Private companies are involved in this. It is no longer seen as an obligation by governments, and there will be increasing struggles over water as well. So in various different ways, indigenous people will find themselves under a lot of pressure. And as we know, a great deal of knowledge, of indigenous knowledge associated, for example, with biodiversity, is also being appropriated by private corporations as the basis for a new generation of intellectual property rights, which are the basis for huge profits. And this, too, will become a very major area of contention. All this will be worsened by the fact that with the crisis, prices will come down, and many countries, developing countries especially, will be under a lot of pressure to increase their exports. This will mean much more mineral exploitation. This will mean much more use of land for agricultural purposes and for other purposes as well. And this will put indigenous communities under a great deal of pressure. Thank you very much for your attention.
I'd like to thank Mr. Jomo Sundaram, the Assistant Secretary General of Economic and Social Affairs, for giving us an overview of the global economic crisis which we are confronted with now, and also for mentioning the potential impacts, and actually some of the actual impacts already on indigenous peoples. And we will be still having him with us for a few minutes, but I would like to now move to our elder, Mr. Nicholas Lucas Ticum, who is a sacerdote, a Maya sacerdote from Guatemala. And we purposely invited an elder because they are the ones who have also these predictions of what is going to be coming in this future year. So I would like to ask Mr. Nicholas Lucas Ticum to take the floor.
Señora Presidenta.
Madam Chairperson, distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, distinguished representatives of states, indigenous brothers and sisters of the world, I wish you all a good day, a good morning. And I bring you a message from the Mayans of yesterday and of today for the future of the human race. On 21 December 2012, the Mayan 13 Bactun begins. This is the equivalent of 5,200 years of 360 days each. According to Mayan wisdom, the 13th Bactun means change for the human race. It means a new era, in which there will be self-respect and respect for others, respect for love, solidarity, and brotherhood and sisterhood among all people. At this 8th session of the Forum of the Indigenous Peoples, I think it is important to think about the future of the human race and the future of Mother Earth. Our Mother Earth is alive. She is the mother of all living beings that coexist on this sacred planet Earth. All parts of the universe are alive. Each part has its own mission. And all the parts of the universe are very closely interconnected one with the other. We're going to have the video shown as well.
El 13 Bactún Maya. Un Bactún equivale a un periodo de 5.200 años Tún. El Tún tiene 360.
The 13th Bactun means it will be a change for our people. It presages better times for all the peoples of the world. There will be an end to hatred, racism, individualism, inequality among people, because the Creator has brought us peace to the earth. We have to feed everybody. We all have the same blood in our veins. We are all beings of equal value. In Guatemala, they say there was a prophecy of our predecessors and that human beings will begin to integrate with all living beings, becoming aware that everything is alive and we are part of that everything, and that we can exist and live in a new era of light. Guatemala is the heart of Mayan culture. We have to look after the children, the boys and girls, so that they will learn to live in peace with nature. It's very important to begin with the children so that harmony is complete. The prophecies say that there will be a rise in the Earth's temperature. There will be geological, social, cultural changes of unprecedented magnitude and at unprecedented speeds. We are at the end of the 12th Bactun, and the 13th Bactun will begin in 2012 with the day of our predecessors. There have been difficulties with climate change, and now we are saying that we have to look after Mother Earth and nature. This is the message of the Mayan people to the world. Our elders tell us that the result of an increase in the temperatures caused by human activity and greater activity by the sun will lead to certain devastation. And this is global warming. I myself am a spiritual being. I am here for a certain period, and I would call on everybody to join together, to come together in union with Mother Earth and Father Sky.
Los mayas hicieron...
The Mayans made extremely impressive structures in the northern part of our country during the age of Mayan splendor. Palenque, Coban, Rio Azul, and there are many other sites in the area. Some of them have now been declared the heritage of mankind.
El Baktun.
Baktun, the Baktun of the change. This is a moment full of the most important times in the entire world. The international scientific community has declared that development and population growth, if it continues at the same rate, will mean that by 2050 there will be too much carbon dioxide, because, and this relates to industrial production. This can have fatal consequences for life on Earth. The Kyoto Protocol. The Mayans and the indigenous peoples of Latin America, the Ayala, we are the ones who are looking after the environment overall. We are looking after the environment because that is what is going to give us a better future for our children and grandchildren. The governments at the United Nations meeting in Kyoto, Japan, in 1997, signed the Kyoto Protocol to reduce greenhouse gases produced by developed countries 5.2% over what had been produced in 1990. The Mayans have been, are, and will continue to work towards the new Baktun. The imbalances that have occurred must be remedied by the work of men and women, and we call on everybody, one and all, in every country of the world, to join together so that we find once again harmony, togetherness with the cosmos, with the Mother Earth, with the Hao, with all elements in the cosmos.
Recordemos la sabiduría.
Let us remember the wisdom of our peoples. Everything that happens to Earth also happens to people on the Earth.
El ser humano.
The human being is one integrated, holistic whole. The mission being to ensure balance, unity, harmony, and complementarity. The Earth does not belong to the human race. Rather, human beings belong to the Earth. As Chief Sitley said in the year 1855, what happens to the Earth will also happen to the children of the Earth. However, the utilitarian and economic philosophical concepts that were reflected in the policies, programs, and plans of so many Western countries has meant that the human being is now losing his true sense of being a human being. There was a gradual process in which the quality of life of the majority of the people on Earth declined. And this was because of the dogmatic approach taken, the rationalist, egoistical, and exclusivist approach. As a result, because of an irrational trade system, biological diversity and our genetic heritage have declined. And life on planet Earth is now being threatened by the human race because of environmental degradation, because of climate change, because of global warming, and because of the loss of diversity, biological, cultural, and linguistic diversity. We would call for everybody to take a new path forward. Vegetable, mineral, animal, human, and cosmic life. We would call on governments, universities, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, the major corporations, all of which have been controlling international economics and politics. We would say to them, it is a matter of urgency that universities and scientific research centers recognize the spiritual dimension of human existence, the connections and the interconnections among all of the elements making up the universe, and that they recognize scientific pluralism. It is a matter of great urgency that the major multinational corporations, governments, and United Nations bodies recognized that much of the imbalance, the climate change, the global warming, the environmental crisis, the threat to biological and cultural diversity, that all of this is the result of a accumulation-based model of development and the current monetary and trade system, and that they recognize that planet Earth is in fact our mother. It is the home of all living beings. The International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, the United Nations Development Programme, the World Food Programme, and governments must recognize that the sustainable development they have been advocating for centuries is something that from time immemorial the indigenous peoples have been practicing to ensure a good life and to ensure respect for vegetable, mineral, animal, human, and cosmic life. All of this means that it is crucial to recognize economic pluralism. In other words, we have to recognize the production models of the indigenous peoples and other age-old cultures. We have to change a change single crop systems. We have to move towards diversity and pluralism in our scientific, legal, political, economic, production, social, cultural, linguistic, and religious approaches to life, in order that we can all have a life of dignity and of well-being and of respect. And we would call on the Commission on Sustainable Development of the United Nations to review and adapt concepts about the environment, natural resources, development, and economics. And we would call on them to include concepts that come from the thinking and the age-old experience of the indigenous peoples. Concepts that can be used to ensure life for every living being and in the universe and planet Earth. And we would appeal to the entire human race, to the ancient cultural systems of the world. Let them breathe new life into their age-old wisdom, their knowledge, their understanding, the contributions that they make to looking after Mother Earth. Biological and cultural diversity, the genetic heritage, the ecosystems, and the right to self-determination. Alliances must be built, coalitions developed, strategies must be produced to support a model of sustainable endogenous development at every level of life, which would respect vegetable, mineral, animal, human, and cosmic life. So as to ensure life for future generations. It is essential that we show the entire human race that the sacred elements of existence are Mother Earth, water, air, fire. Pluralism is indeed a great wealth for the human race. Through states and governments, people have made a global effort to set targets and goals to avoid global warming, and they did this in the Kyoto Protocol. The challenge now is for all member states. To undertake to discharge their responsibilities for life on Earth. The Kyoto Protocol is indeed in the same vein as the vision of the indigenous peoples, in that it deals with balance crucial to life. The first review of the Kyoto Protocol will be held in 2012, a year which coincides with the 13th Baktun of the Mayan people. The challenges are huge because all people have to act together. All people working through their states, their nations, their governments. The 13th Baktun will require a spiritual strength because we have some. For we will suffer consequences if we do not act together. So let us all walk together towards the new Baktun. On this path, we need to support life, balance, and harmony for all human beings and for all other living beings in the universe. As our sacred book says, that is the Popol Vuh, may day dawn for the human race. Thank you very much.
I'd like to warmly thank Mr. Nicholas Lucas Tikum, who gave us his views and his observation of what is happening to the earth now and the challenges that are before us as indigenous peoples. I would like to take the floor now to walk you through some of the items that I have identified in relation to the impacts of the global economic crisis on indigenous peoples. Basically, I would just go very fast into the nature and effects of the crisis, the impacts on indigenous peoples, the impacts of responses to global economic crisis like stimulus plans, and what are the challenges for us. First, as was mentioned by Mr. Jomo Sundaram, this crisis really has been caused by extensive capital market liberalization. As we have seen in the past 30 years or so, the social goals that have been agreed upon by international community, like full employment, human rights protection, equity, etc., have been delinked, have been separated from economic policies. No? And so in those periods, in the years when they have really went into full liberalization and deregulation, this has been a period of growing inequality, and there have been tremendous changes in state and market relations. No? The role of the state in terms of regulating finance capital, among others, has really been drastically reduced because the whole ideology that the market is always right has prevailed in many of the economic policies adopted not only by the developed country governments but also in the developing countries, because this was the advice or prescription that has been given to them by multilateral institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, among others. We have seen a lot of labor market informalization, you know, instead of really getting the labor contracts that will ensure your stability in your working place. There is a lot of contractualization. There is a lot of the violations of labor rights have been so extensive in most parts of the world. And then, of course, we have seen the rise in the structural and instrumental power of financial institutions and transnational corporations. And this has been clearly seen when we had our expert group meeting on extractive industries, corporate social responsibility, and indigenous people's rights. So in general, there was really a disembedding or separation of the economy from society and from democratic politics. And this is where this whole deregulation has come in which the democratic politics that will allow peoples or citizens to influence economic policies of states and of course of the market are really undermined extensively. Of course, we can also say that the countries most adversely affected are those who opened up to the global economy the most. And you have seen the graph that Jomo Sundaram has shown, which has shown how these countries that have been affected the most. Now I'd like to move into the impacts. We don't have a lot of time, so we cannot bring a lot of data on this, but in many indigenous communities, there have definitely been an increase in poverty, and this is for many reasons. Of course, one reason is the increase in appropriation or expropriation of indigenous people's lands, territories, and resources without their consent, no? And many of these lands have been used for purposes that meet the needs of transnational corporations and other business enterprises. There has been the increasing threat of losing lands and homes, and this is losing indigenous territories and lands, as well as losing homes, because I think even in countries like Canada, the United States, which is hit by the subprime crisis, I was told that there are indigenous peoples who have been affected by this. And not only indigenous peoples who are living in these countries, but also indigenous peoples who are migrants, because they are the first ones who are being offered loans by the banks and the investment houses. And in the end, many of them cannot pay for these loans. So there is an increased number of indigenous peoples who have to go back to their own communities, go back to their own countries, because of the loss of their homes as well as their jobs. In my country, in the Philippines, we have seen the increased coming back, you know, the returning home of some of these migrant workers, and of course a very significant decrease in the remittances that are being used by our own economy. Our economy is very reliant, it's on remittances from overseas contract workers, and this has been drastically reduced. And I think this is the same case for countries like Mexico, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, all these countries who are sending out their people to work overseas. So these are just some of the problems related to the poverty, increasing impoverishment of indigenous peoples. We have also seen the destruction of traditional livelihoods, no? And this is caused by a lot of things. Of course, firstly, the main economic model doesn't really have any sympathy for indigenous people's traditional livelihoods, because these are livelihoods that occupy big areas of lands, and these lands are wanted by corporations for logging, mining, and other extractive industries. Economic insecurity, food insecurity has increased, and we have seen, as I said, an increase in extractive industries. There has also been a strong decrease in access to health care and other social services. Jomo Sundaram mentioned earlier about the social spending has gone so low that there are now many indigenous people who are not sending their children to schools anymore, because they need these children to earn additional income for the family. And this is seen, not I don't know in here in the richer parts of the world, but definitely in many parts of the developing world, there have been reports about the decrease in indigenous children going to school because of the crisis. The first thing that is affected when you have a crisis is, of course, to stop all the possibilities for you to spend. And even if primary education is cheap, many indigenous people say they have to buy uniforms, they have to give money to the kids for their lunch, they have to buy pencils, and they don't have that cash to give to their children. And therefore, they have to stop a lot of children from going to school. The health services have definitely been decreased significantly. There are now many hospitals and rural health centers which do not have even the most basic medicines that indigenous communities need. And this also has been documented even by the World Health Organization, the decrease in health care services as well as health and medical supplies. This is the issue that I would like to raise here also, because there is now an increase in infrastructure spending. As you might have read, there is a need to prime up the economy, because the economy is really a recession in many countries. So there is a lot of money being put into government so that they can increase infrastructure spending, and this means that they will employ more people. they will be able to buy more goods and services, and this is what they think is going to make the economy rise up after this recession. And this is a data from the World Bank. The World Bank has told us that the investments, the loans that they are going to extend for infrastructure has increased just this year from $15 billion to $45 billion U.S. dollars. And they are required to give these loans as fast as they can to many of the developing countries, and also to reduce, actually not to require a lot of conditions, especially, of course, using the safeguard mechanisms that they are put into place. So while we see a situation where the World Bank has a policy on indigenous peoples, this policy might not be used very significantly because of the need to prime up the economy. And we are very, very concerned about this because we are now seeing a lot of infrastructure projects in our own communities, whether these are roads, bridges, hydroelectric dams for energy, among others. And these infrastructure projects are going to mean displacement of indigenous peoples from their lands, of course, not necessarily getting their prior informed consent. And the indigenous peoples who have made some reports on this have really confirmed this. For instance, in the Philippines alone, we do have an increase in infrastructure. In India, like they have, the Northeast Indians have said that just in Arunachal Pradesh alone, there are 158 hydroelectric dams in the pipeline, and there are now increased extraction of uranium, other minerals, and oil and gas, because roads are going to be built to go into these areas where these resources are found. I just would like to cite one example here in the north, and this is data that we gathered from Canada, that they said that there is also an increase in infrastructure building in Canada, which is $33 billion Canadian dollars for several years under an institution called Building Canada Fund. And according to the data, this Canada Fund, Building Canada Fund, has, like for instance, the Ontario Liberal government announced in 2008 in its quote, open for business guide to reduce burden, that it is cutting regulations in every ministry by 25%. And reviews are very much weakened, such as environmental impact reviews, social impact reviews, etc. And another data which came in is that $115 million Canadian dollars is also being used by Infrastructure Canada and the British Columbia government to expand a number of sections of Highway 97, which is a key part of the corridor leading up to the NAFTA trade flow through Manitoba with British Columbia's Pacific ports. And indigenous peoples have raised concerns about this because this will increase further developments in mining, oil, and gas industries. Highway 30, another highway that's going to be further strengthened, of Quebec and Quebec and Infrastructure Canada have appropriated a lot of money for this also, and now this is leading towards the appropriation of agricultural land in unceded Mohawk territory along Montreal's South Shore. No, and this has evoked a strong response from the Ganawaki community, and there are some protests that you can see here and there happening because of this issue. And finally, there is the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, which is the largest infrastructure project in Canadian history, which will cost $16.2 billion Canadian dollars. And this is also going to affect indigenous peoples in this valley. These are just a few examples of how infrastructure spending has increased tremendously. And, you know, these are meant to pump prime the economy, but of course, indigenous peoples who live in these communities are the ones who will be directly affected. So while the response to the economic crisis is moving towards this direction, the issue of indigenous peoples, how they are going to be affected, has not been really dealt with very adequately. So finally, I would just like to say that in the light of these kinds of examples, there are many, many more examples that we can cite, but we don't have the time for that. And next year, the Permanent Forum has already agreed that a particular study on this issue is going to be made. No? But anyhow, in terms of challenges, these are the things that I think should be really looked into by indigenous peoples, that the human rights-based approach to development, which means for us the implementation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, should be ensured when these different projects are put into place, and the integration of indigenous peoples in designing the responses to the crisis should also be ensured. We are going to help solve the crisis because we are the ones who have lived sustainably for many years, for thousands of years, and these sustainable systems, economic and cultural and social systems that we have, can really play a very important role in addressing the economic crisis that is faced by everybody. We also would like to see that this is linked with the ecosystem approach and also linked with the responses to the climate change crisis. We don't see the climate change crisis and the global economic crisis as two different things. They are actually caused exactly by the same economic model. And this is why we are requesting, we are also appealing that these two issues be dealt with in an integrated way. And of course, we would like to strengthen, we would like to really urge all agencies and indigenous organizations as well as NGOs to strengthen indigenous people's organizations, movements, and struggles, because this we see is the solution to ensuring that we are not going to get the raw end of the crisis that everybody is facing now. So this is just an overview of the report that we might be coming up with next year, and we would like to get information from all of you on how you are affected, as well as the solutions that you think can be brought into the attention of international community that indigenous peoples can provide. Thank you very much. So these are the inputs, the contributions on the issue of economic crisis. I would like now to move on to the next report that we would like to hear on, and this is the report that was presented, that was made by our rapporteur, Mick Dodson, which is the report on land tenure. And so I would like to give him the floor to make a summary also of the report. Sorry. The report that he has made. And this report you can see in your own folders or in the desk behind, it's a CRP paper. So I would like to give the floor to my distinguished colleague, Mr. Mick Dodson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, everyone. The report entitled A Draft Guide on the Relevant Principles contained in the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, International Labour Organization Convention No. 169, and International Labour Organization Convention No. 107 that relate to Indigenous land tenure and management arrangements. It's contained in document E-C-19-2009-CRP-7. At the sixth session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, the forum appointed me as a special rapporteur to prepare a draft guide to Indigenous land tenure and management arrangements, and based on the principles that are contained in the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and International Labour Organisation Convention No. 169 that might assist Indigenous peoples, states and the United Nations agencies in negotiating land tenure and management arrangement. The forum received advice from the International Labour Organisation that International Labour Organisation Convention number 107 was still relevant and binding on a number of states that had ratified it, and it should also be examined in relation to Indigenous land tenure and management arrangements. Now, I was unable to complete the paper in a lot of time, and at the seventh session of the forum, agreed to extend my time so I could report this year at this session, the eighth session. I'm very grateful for the assistance received from the International Labour Organisation, particularly in identifying useful cases, case studies that shed light on the practical relevance of the theoretical aspects of this report. I'm also greatly indebted and appreciative of assistance provided to me by Ms. Joanne Weinman, a research associate with the National Centre for Indigenous Studies at the Australian National University. The the report is looks at relevant articles in all three instruments and divides them into two broad categories. Firstly, provisions in the instruments that bear directly on relevant principles that relate to lands, territories and natural resources, either by express inclusion of the words themselves or by necessary implication. And secondly, provisions that bear indirect relevance. And in this category, there are two subsets. Now, those that are largely administrative or general provisions that are applicable to the entire instrument, as well as those provisions that focus mainly on another aspect but may perhaps have repercussions for Indigenous peoples' interest in lands, territories and natural resources, depending on the construction that gains credence in international jurisprudence. The the paper appends all the relevant articles of the three instruments as appendices, and also included in the paper are as an appendix is some selected references for those who want to more deeply examine some of the basis for the paper. The paper examines Indigenous people's rights to self-determination and how that's reflected in the three instruments examined. It looks at full and direct consultation and participation of Indigenous peoples, the free, prior, informed consent of Indigenous peoples, the rights of Indigenous peoples to traditional lands, waters, territories and resources, the principles of respect for Indigenous cultural practices, traditions, laws and institutions, the right to reparation for injury to or loss of Indigenous interests in land, territory and resources, the right to non-discrimination against Indigenous people's interests, and looks at the principle of respect for the rule of law. Madam Chairperson, I don't think there's much else I can say about the paper, and I commend it to the forum. Thank you.
Thank you very much, my colleague, Mr. Mick Dodson. At this point, I would like to open the floor for some questions related to the economic crisis presentation. Although Jomo Sundaram is not here, we will try our best. So if there are questions that you would like to, if there is anybody in the room who would like to ask questions, we are opening this very briefly, and then we will move on to, we will reopen the list of the Indigenous peoples who have enlisted under the human rights agenda item, so we can still give some chance to a few people there. And the ones who are in the list now for this agenda item on future work, we will call on them this afternoon. So I would like to see whether there are hands up in relation to, there's a question in relation to the economic crisis. Yes, you have the floor. Please mention your name and your organization.
Okay. Lori Johnston, Yamasi People and Southeast Indigenous People Center. The chair mentioned that the economic crisis was caused by the same economic model that caused the climate crisis. Do we have coordination with other UN agencies to enable Indigenous peoples to create a coherent response to these integrated problems?
Thank you very much. We will deal with that. I'd like to see if there are additional hands for questions on this. Yes, Mr. Balkasam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I wish to thank the speakers who have taken the floor this morning and who have spoken about several issues for discussion. First of all, I wish to thank Mr. Nicholas, who presented an analysis of the current situation. From the standpoint of the Maya, he emphasized the way in which he analyzes the issue and the ideas he concluded are not any less significant than those conclusions reached by revealed religions. And perhaps that is a very important contribution on the part of Mr. Nicholas. It is also important to consider a dialogue between the revealed religions and the metaphysical religions. The other point I wish to make relates to the situation of Indigenous peoples and the current world crisis, as well as the impact, its impact and consequences for Indigenous peoples. We have reached free trade agreements, and that has meant that governments in the framework of cooperation with the corporations and major enterprises in tourism and other areas, mining corporations, have all given land of indigenous peoples to those corporations. It means that they have, that those citizens are now even weaker faced with the current crisis. I have a question. Firstly, of course, I wish to thank the chair for her good management of this very important meeting. And I have a question about the possibility of reaching recommendations to be submitted by this body to the June conference on the financial crisis. And the contribution of indigenous peoples there would have to include the need for states to respect a minimum level of the values embodied in the Declaration on Indigenous Peoples and the need to review all policies which have led to the confiscation of their territory, because without territory, without natural resources, those peoples are most vulnerable given the current financial global crisis. Lastly, I would like to table an idea of ideas on carbon. Everyone refers to the crisis and to the enormous amounts which can be allocated to the carbon market. Certain governments and corporations which do not respect the rights of indigenous peoples and which take measures to confiscate gas and other resources and try to dislodge indigenous peoples from their forests and territories, that represents a major threat for indigenous peoples. And therefore, I would like us to recommend, to make a recommendation, and how can we convey those recommendations on the financial crisis to the World Summit to take place in June? Thank you.
The last one is Tomas Alarcon, and then I'll have two only now, Tomas Alarcon and our colleague from Hawaii. Yes, Tomas Alarcon, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning to all. On behalf of the Kapako organization, we would like to thank Mike Dobson for the report he has presented, and I wish to thank you for having informed us about the report on climate change. We believe that indigenous peoples through the years have made a contribution to well-being, have made a contribution to ecologic stability in the planet, but so far there has been no evaluation, nor has there been an assessment of our contribution to climate stability in the planet. For thousands of years, we have been contributing and we have made sacrifices to ensure that ecological balance guarantees the survival of all. However, these sacrifices are not being assessed in economic terms. In other words, mankind has a debt toward us, and it is perfectly measurable. It can be quantified. But since we have not been paid for those services, we are living in extreme poverty, and we suffer even more from the economic crisis. And our question is, Madam Chair, can you consider in your reports establishing a mechanism to assess, to value in concrete terms the contribution of indigenous peoples to ecologic environmental stability, and to include the possibility that we be compensated for our contributions to climate stability? Thank you.
Our colleague from Hawaii, it will be the last speaker, and then we'll move to the answer.
Aloha, Lili Kala Kame'ele Hiva from Hawaii, Kamakaku Okalani Center for Hawaiian Studies, University of Hawaii. Madam Chair, I am very moved by the presentation this morning by all of the panelists. I think this is such a grave situation, and I would hope that the members of the Permanent Forum would make these statements and send a report to the government of America, which has led in all of these problems, not only of climate change, but also in instability of the economic situation of America, of the world. And so this is something I think that President Obama needs to understand how it is affecting all indigenous peoples of the world. Thank you.
Now, the Vice Minister of Culture of Guatemala also wants to take the floor. You have the floor, Madam.
Muchas gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The indigenous people of Guatemala, throughout their struggle carried out for years, have made some progress in Guatemala. Despite the fact that Guatemala is one of the countries in Latin America where there is most inequality, more than 50% of the indigenous population, the current government is beginning to recognize the rights of indigenous peoples and is beginning to recognize their contribution to the development of the country and to the maintenance of forests and of a healthy environment. In this manner, we fully agree with the position of Cirilo with regard to caring for Mother Nature, and this is an invitation to all countries to bear in mind that without Mother Earth, without Mother Nature, our life in this planet would not be possible. The government of Guatemala promotes this idea and these feelings of indigenous peoples. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, the Vice Minister of Culture of Guatemala. I have one last speaker there. Can you? Who is the one speaking? Excuse me. Are you the one speaking? Yes, please be brief.
Gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I have listened with some concern to the reports offered by the panelists. I think that we have to focus more on the situation of the indigenous peoples on the planet, given the economic crisis and climate change. Both factors derive from a system which has been being developed very aggressively, that is accumulation of great wealth for just a few large corporations, the World Bank, the IMF, the Inter-American Development Bank, inter alia. And so, Madam Chairperson, I think that we have to focus on this. Climate change caused by this excessive accumulation on the planet is something that happens in all of the ecosystems, in the tropics, in the forests, everywhere. And it affects the flora and fauna and the biomass throughout the earth. And so I think that the reports should be highlighted, and I think that the indigenous people should recuperate this. It's not just the World Bank and the IMF that should deplete our forests. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now I would just like to briefly respond, and then I'll call on some of the people who have inscribed their names, but I will also go back to the list on human rights. First of all, the question regarding the coordinated efforts between the various UN agencies. As you might have heard, Mr. Sundaram mentioned that there's going to be a General Assembly meeting on the economic crisis here on June 20 to 2024, around that time. And I think that suggestion by our colleague that we should be able to have some input in that is an important thing. It's the General Assembly which has the power to gather together all the different actors, you know, involved in economic crisis as well as in climate change. And I think this is one of the ways in which we would like to really feed the concerns that we have related to economic crisis. As you know, the Permanent Forum has also been actively engaged with the Framework Convention on Climate Change negotiations, and indigenous peoples are the ones who have been there since this negotiation started. So this is also another mechanism. There will be a meeting next month, June 1 to 12, in Bonn, which will negotiate all the different agenda items on climate that will be agreed upon in Copenhagen. And these are agenda items related to adaptation, mitigation, finance, technology transfer, and a shared vision on long-term cooperative action. These are the issues that are going to be addressed there. And some indigenous peoples are, together with some developing countries, many developing countries, in fact, are really going to bring into the fore the whole issue of historical debt. No, that the rich, the Annex I countries are the ones who have historically contributed to 85% of the greenhouse gas emissions that we are all suffering from today. No, and this debt has to be paid through, of course, the transfer of finances as well as technology transfer, so that the developing countries who are obliged to also lower their greenhouse gas emissions can still pursue their own kind of development without necessarily having to cut back on everything. Everyone is required to cut back on their emissions, but the ones who have been contributing the most should be the ones carrying the heavier burden of cutting back their emissions. No? And we will discuss that much again in this afternoon when we deal with climate change. But this historical debt is very much related to the economic crisis, because the historical debt is being calculated already in terms of how many gigatons of carbon are owed by the rich countries to the poor countries, and also the poor peoples in all of these countries. No? So this is an issue that has to be dealt with. Finally, the possibility, I responded to Mr. Alarcon about the possibility of addressing the June conference, and also the whole issue of considering in our reports a mechanism for ecological environmental stability, which is also part of the historical debt that we are all talking about. No, and I would like to ask my colleague, Mr. Nicolas Lucas Ticom, if he wants to say something regarding the point that was raised earlier about your vision and your perspective in relation to the crisis that we face now. So would you like to say a few words before we move on to the next agenda item?
Sobre de la crisis económico mundial que
the world economic crisis which is happening now. It is happening as we approach the 13th Baktun. This happens every 1,040 years. It is written in the codex left to us by our predecessors. It was because of the invasion of our lands and the great wisdom that we had accumulated was then destroyed. And much was lost. It is not by chance that what is happening now is happening. The indigenous peoples have to study this, but as we are poor, we do not have the resources to do this research. But we should really study thoroughly what has been bequeathed to us by those who came before us, the mathematics, the movement of Earth through space, all of this is written down. It is written down by the codex bequeathed to us. We don't have it all because some of it was destroyed. I myself am struggling hard to understand all that was written down and bequeathed to us. But it is not complete, so we have to complete it. But as we are poor, it is very difficult to do this. So that is all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nicolas Lucas Ticum, the Maya sacerdote from Guatemala, for coming here and sharing your wisdom with us. These are very important wisdoms that we need to know, especially the younger generation. And I'm sure we will be more enlightened about this as we talk with you and also other elders of indigenous peoples. Thank you very much. I would like now to move on to the list of three governments who wanted to speak on this item, and I call on Australia, Ms. Shirley McPherson, who would like to speak on the issue of land tenure. You have the floor, Madam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The achievements of the Indigenous land rights movement in Australia are significant. Indigenous landowners now own or manage approximately 20% of the Australian continent. The Aboriginal Land Rights Northern Territory Act 1976, legislated by the Australian Government, is the most significant land rights legislation in Australia. This means that around half of the land in the Northern Territory is owned by Aboriginal people. Traditional landowners in the Northern Territory are the key decision makers for their land and must give their consent for mineral exploration and mining on Aboriginal land. Agreements regularly include employment targets and other socio-economic benefits in addition to royalty payments. Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islanders also own and hold interests in land in other parts of Australia under a variety of state and territory land rights schemes. As well as these various state and territory schemes, native title is recognised over certain parts of Australia. There are fundamental differences between land rights and native title. Land rights are created at a government level and usually comprise a grant of freehold or perpetual lease title to Indigenous Australians. In contrast, native title arises as a result of the recognition under Australian common law of Indigenous rights and interests according to traditional Indigenous laws and customs. It is not a grant or right created by governments. In 1992, Mabo legislation, the High Court of Australia recognised that the Meriman people of the Torres Strait Island held native title over part of their traditional lands. The Native Title Act of 1993 commenced on the 1st of January 1994. It has a number of functions, including setting up processes through which native title can be recognised and providing protection for native title rights and interests. Native title cannot be transferred, bought or sold. Native title rights are often communal in nature. In some cases, native title includes the right to possess and occupy an area to the exclusion of all others. This includes the right to control access to and use of the area concerned. Native Title Act also contains provisions for Indigenous land use agreements. These are voluntary agreements made with native title parties about the use and management of land and waters, and involve the native title parties giving their agreement or consent to acts that affect their native title rights. The Australian government considers that where possible, land use and ownership issues should be resolved through mediation and negotiation rather than litigation. The Australian government continues to be committed to improving outcomes for Indigenous people by not only recognising their rights to land, but also ensuring that these rights provide lasting economic and social benefits. For Indigenous Australians to have the prospect of a stronger economic future, Indigenous communities must be able to better leverage their land assets and native title rights. The government is committed to assisting native title holders and Indigenous landowners to maximise sustainable benefits from their land. New land arrangements in townships on Indigenous held land must encourage investment to foster individual and community economic development. Land arrangements should create the conditions for Indigenous communities to prosper, both in terms of employment and economic opportunities, as well as positive social and cultural outcomes. The Indigenous Land Corporation, which I have the honour to chair, is a statutory authority whose role is to assist Indigenous people to acquire and manage land to achieve economic, environmental, social and cultural benefits. The ILC is committed to working with Indigenous organisations and in collaboration with industry groups and other agencies to create socio-economic opportunities for Indigenous people on Indigenous held land in urban, rural and remote Australia. The Australian government, the states and territories and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are working in partnership to ensure that owners and residents of Indigenous held land can use it as a meaningful foundation for greater participation in the economy that yields real and lasting improvements both now and for future generations. The collaborative approach that this reflects the Australian government's commitment to make Indigenous engagement a cornerstone of its strategy in addressing Indigenous disadvantage. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to call now on the representative of the government of Indonesia, Mr. Hafid Abbas. You have the floor, sir.
Madam Chair, esteemed members of the forum, let me begin by emphasizing that Indonesia attached great importance to the work of UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. We value the members of the forum's effort in building its institution as a constructive forum to bridge the real needs of the Indigenous people and advance this issue within the United Nations system. As a democratic country, we welcome and encourage a lively debate about complex issues that affect our society. Madam Chair, Indonesia is a country of more than 400 ethnic groups. Our delegation to this important meeting is a clear testimony of our diversity. But our diversity does not disunite us into little silos. It unites us more than ever, as stipulated in our national five principles called Pancasila. We embrace diversity because we know that diversity enriches our culture for just and civilized humanities. It is a source of strength, a source of inspiration, and a source of knowledge. And it is also a source of moderation and a source of tolerance. Since the end of the last decade, Indonesia had made a historic choice to transform itself into a democratic nation. We, civilian and military alike, are committed in the promotion and protection of human rights. There is no single ounce doubt in this spirit. We also decide to decentralize our political system, enabling local government, local authorities, local communities to participate in the overall political system. This new political development strategy has yielded tangible results. It's empowered region and all ethnic groups in addressing their unique needs and social economic challenges. Their share in development gains had significantly increased. But our efforts do not stop there. As a part of our comprehensive policies and strategies to protect and promote the livelihood and traditional way of life of all ethnic groups, we engage in international community. Indonesia strongly committed toward various regional and global issues, such as climate change, preservation of forests and oceans. This has been reflected in our recent contribution in events such as United Nations for Climate Change Conference we made in Bali last 2007, and World Ocean Conference we made it in Manado in eastern part of Indonesia this year, and in initiating the Forestry 11. However, Madam Chair, this is not an occasion to congratulate ourselves. We precisely know that Indonesia is a country that is not immune from flaws. Much more need to be done and improved. In this regard, we recognize that this forum has provided member countries with the means to listen and learn, to share new ideas and best practices. This forum can also promote partnership toward the betterment of societies. We should not lose this perspective. Madam Chair, in discussing the future work of the Permanent Forum, we acknowledge that the challenges faced by the Forum is discharging its duties is far from easy, and there is a call for the Forum to improve its methods of work. The existing procedures adopted by other functional commissions of ECOSOC could serve as its guiding tools. We fervently feel that the continued improvement of its working method is the key for the overall success of the forum. Indonesia reiterates that the principle of free, prior, and informed consent must be applied in every phase of the forum decision-making process. This will ensure a greater transparency, greater responsibility, greater trust and accountability of the forum when it deals with any issue that requires its attention. In this regard, Madam Chair, we are certain that the Secretariat of the Forum will always continue to uphold its solemn responsibility in safeguarding the trust and honesty of member states. This is crucial in maintaining the Forum's credibility, maintaining accountability and effectiveness at all times. I thank you, Madam Chair.
I would like to thank warmly the representative of the observer state of Indonesia, Mr. Hafid Abbas, and I would like to assure you that we are doing our best to make sure that we are transparent in anything that we do, and that we are also allowing the people to express their views here, but also in a constructive manner. We do appreciate the concerns of the observer states, as well as the concerns, of course, of the indigenous participants who are here. Thank you very much, sir. Now, I told you earlier that I'm going to open up the list on the under the human rights agenda item 4, because there is almost like 50 people who haven't had the chance to speak. I know that several of them have left already, so we crossed out the names of those who have left. But those who are remaining in the list, we will try to accommodate them as best as we can. And then this afternoon, we will move on to the move back to item 7, which is on the future work. We do also have a list of indigenous people who would like to speak, as well as governments under that agenda item. So let me ask my colleague Tonya to sit to be the chair for now. But I would first like to call on Nait Sid Kamira from the Amasir Caucus, if she is around. Is Nait Sid around? No? She has. Are you are there? Okay, so I'll ask you to make your speeches, but please be brief. We will time your interventions again to 2 to 3 minutes. You have the floor, madam. No? Okay. They have opted not to say anything. Then I will call on Angelia Munoz. Is Angelia Munoz here from the Global Women's Caucus? She is not here. I'll call on Craig Cromelin. Is Craig Cromelin here from the Australian National Native Title Council? Craig is here. Okay, so you have the floor, sir. And next, after Craig Tumilin, we are going to call on Jethro Tulin. No? So please, if Jethro is around, yes. Craig Tumilin, you have the floor.
It's on. Thank you. We begin this statement with an offering of the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council's support for the intent of the joint statement delivered by the representative of the Australian Government last Thursday. It is our sincere hope that our statement today can also provide an important step in building trust and moving forward to a new support. Notwithstanding our support, the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council would like to use this opportunity to raise our concern regarding the Australian Government's proposal to link the provision of housing services with existing land tenure arrangements. We do so mindful that this is one issue on which we may not agree, but knowing that we can engage in a discussion in an open and respectful way. The statutory recognition of land rights in the state of New South Wales is one of the most positive developments in the colonial history of Australia. As the preamble to the Aboriginal Land Rights Act states, it is fitting to acknowledge the importance which land has for Aborigines and the need for Aborigines for land. The very same preamble also acknowledges that land rights system was established in New South Wales as a means of compensating Aboriginal people for the dispossession of our lands. While land rights is a critical element in providing social and economic development for Aboriginal people in New South Wales, such objectives cannot arise at the expense of surrendering our hard-fought rights to land. Put simply, our rights to land are not a commodity that can be traded in return for the enjoyment of fundamental citizenship rights such as the provision of adequate housing. The current proposal put forward by the Australian Government is that in New South Wales it will provide significant funding to support Aboriginal housing over 5 years in exchange for the leasing of our lands back to the Australian Government for 40 years. It should be noted that this arrangement will not apply to all Aboriginal people and communities across New South Wales. It will only apply to people and communities in remote areas, thus requiring the Aboriginal people and communities in urban and rural areas only have access to the services provided through mainstream social housing system. Such a proposal is not only an affront to the members of the land rights system, it contradicts the rationale for the Aboriginal Housing Act, which is also currently in operation in New South Wales. It should also be noted that should the Australian Government implement this proposal, it will be in conflict with Articles 37 and 38 of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. We therefore call on the Australian Government, in the spirit of resetting the relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians and building trust, to affirm the commitment to these articles of the Declaration. Alternatively, the Australian Government must, in the same spirit and as an act of good faith, clearly outline all of their qualifications with respect to the Declaration. Mindful that this statement will be considered to be too negative, we remind those who support policies of the Australian Government that the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council has made substantial and practical contribution to improving the living conditions of our people. In this regard, we highlight partnership agreement between our organisation, the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council, and the New South Wales Government to improve the provision of water sewerage services to more than 60 discrete Aboriginal communities across the state of New South Wales. This partnership, established in April 2008, will see New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council allocate a substantial amount of our own funds over a 20-year period. Madam Chairperson, this partnership agreement is one of a number of constructive arrangements through the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council is seeking to be engaged with governments of all persuasion in our state. We are particularly concerned about the need to work more closely with the local and local Shire governments so that we can more effectively take up the challenge of providing services to all of their constituents, irrespective of the land tenure arrangements. We consider that local and Shire governments in New South Wales are often quick to claim unpaid rates, but tend to move a bit slow to ensure that discrete Aboriginal communities receive the services to which they are entitled and pay for. In conclusion, we reaffirm our position that housing and land tenure are separate issues. To combine these issues in the name of Aboriginal economic and social development is not only overtly aggressive, it is counterproductive and will not provide governments with the assurances they are seeking with respect to tenancy and asset management. We call on all levels of government to move forward with us by helping to build the capacity required within Aboriginal organisations to more effectively perform their asset and tenancy management responsibilities, developing strategies and programs to support Aboriginal organisations with the management of their housing functions will provide much more substantial outcomes than simply acquiring our land through a coercive policy framework. Madam Chairperson, the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council welcomes the intervention of the Permanent Forum to maintain its focus on land tenure. It is our view that the association between land tenure and economic and social development must be a critical aspect of this ongoing work. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Kremlin, for your remarks. And we will take note of them, you can be sure. Dear Indigenous brothers and sisters and excellencies, as the chair explained before she left, we have gone back to agenda item number 4, human rights, and we are only calling on the Indigenous organizations and speakers who have not been called on, and we said we would open up that speakers list just for those particular speakers. Now, as the chair explained, we were waiting for one government to arrive under agenda item 3, and that was Ecuador, and he has arrived, so we are going to give him the floor, and then we are going back to agenda item number 4 under human rights for the Indigenous brothers and sisters to speak. And are we clear on this? So I am going to call on the government of Ecuador, Mr. Santiago Chilibaba, and he is speaking, I'm sorry, under agenda item 7. That was the agenda item that we have just been working on all this morning, pardon me, under future work. And then we will move back to the human rights agenda, okay? So, Your Excellency from Ecuador, sir, you have the floor. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ecuador is highly vulnerable to climate change. Local and regional phenomena such as El Niño, whose increase in intensity and frequency undermine the socioeconomic situation of the country. This has given rise to a society in Ecuador which considers the need to undertake immediate and intermediate measures. Recognition of this phenomenon gave rise to forming under the auspices of the United Nations of the International Center for the Research of the El Niño Phenomenon, headquartered in Guayaquil. As everyone knows, greenhouse gas emissions in Ecuador, in absolute terms, are a marginal part of the global emissions which accumulate in the atmosphere and which give rise to global warming. Our country, however, is aware of the fact that global warming is a global problem which calls for comprehensive responses from the international community. Ecuador, under the principle of shared but differentiated responsibilities, has underwritten the Framework Convention on Climate Change of the United Nations and the Kyoto Protocol on to adapt to climate change in a manner commensurate with the priorities of sustainable development. These international instruments for Ecuador are an opportunity to offer guidelines on public policy and to establish clear guidelines about the need for change in energy models and forms of production and consumption. We must recognize that the convention as well as the protocol have not had the desired effect, nor have they led to the countries taking on the necessary responsibility for their greenhouse gas emissions. Therefore, the government of Ecuador has promoted institutional and policy reform, recognizing the rights of peoples and nationalities in Ecuador with programs which respond to the problems of climate change. A clear example of these commitments is the Yasuni Sfingo Tambocha Tiputini ITT initiative, which is a series of blocks with oil and oil fields within the Yasuni National Park. This is not only considered as one of the mega diverse places on the planet, but it is also the home of indigenous peoples. This initiative represents Ecuador's commitment not to exploit oil and to protect those peoples and the biodiversity of the area, avoiding the contamination through solid fuels and promoting the harmonious and sustainable development. The government of Ecuador declared 700,000 hectares of the park as intangible areas. That means that it will be protected from mining activity, from oil and forestry exploitation, and that there will be a conservation of biodiversity. In Yasuni, we're implementing the program on the conservation and the sustainable development of the natural and cultural heritage of the Yasuni biosphere with the support of six bodies of the United Nations, including UNDP, and financed by the UNDP Spain Fund to achieve the MDGs. This program includes the establishment of bodies to implement measures issued by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights in favor of peoples living in voluntary isolation. We have been strengthening the role of research to encompass public policies in the Amazon. The Ecuadorian Institute of Development for the Amazon Region plays the role of validating and transferring appropriate technologies to Amazon actors and to develop science and technology for the conservation of biodiversity to promote a good standard of living, summa causae, a principle recognized in our constitution. Ecuador, in promoting the ITT initiative, will consider throughout the process the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And I would like to appeal to the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues to take a position in favor of this initiative. This could be replicated and could be a viable model for mega-diverse countries such as ours. In conclusion, I wish to use a phrase shared by us by Leonardo Boff when the International Day of Mother Earth was declared on 22 April, and he said, the land cannot continue as it is. The earth, we have to change our mindsets if we want a future of hope. The solution for earth will not drop from the heavens. It will be the result of a coalition of forces in support of a comprehensive ecological conscience, ethical values, humanistic goals, and a new sense of being. Only thus will we honor our common home, our earth, our generous mother. Thank you.
I would like to thank the distinguished representative from Ecuador for keeping within the time limit and for his excellent statement. Thank you, sir. I am going to go back to our human rights agenda item, and please keep your remarks within the time frame. We're going to stay within 2 to 3 minutes. And while you're speaking, please watch the lights. When the yellow light goes on, that means that you have just a few minutes left, a few seconds left, actually, before the red light goes on. So I appeal to you to be diligent. The next speaker on the list is Jethro Tullin from Akalai Tongji Association. Are you in the room, sir? And next on the list will be Dario Rodriguez from the Indigenous World Association. You will be second. So, sir, Jethro, you have the floor. Would you raise your hand, please? Turn your mic on, and you have the floor.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a correction. My statement is on agenda number 4, but on human it's written on a statement on agenda number 7, but it's on human rights. Madam Chair, this is my second time at the UN Permanent Forum, and today my majesty and recommendations are more urgent than before. In my homeland, in the islands of Papua New Guinea, the Ibili and Enga people have seen their traditions turned upside down by influence of large-scale mining projects. In one generation, the mine has brought militarization, corruption, and environmental devastation to a land that previously knew only subsistence farming and alluvial mining. We therefore welcome the participants of the Office of the Special Representation on Business and Human Rights in this session. We urge the forum and the Professor Rage to continue the dialogue. However, this alone is not enough. TNG cooperation is a big problem for Indigenous peoples, and we need a constant monitor on their actions. Last year, I explained that mine guards and police were killing locals and raping our women. There has been 5 more killings and many more rapes since. Last year, I described how our food sources were threatened by mine waste dumped directly into the river system and how my people are exposed to dangerous chemicals like cyanide and mercury. Today, these practices continue. Last year, I complained that the mine is directly next to our homes. And just 3 weeks ago, the government of Papua New Guinea, motivated by reports presented by mining companies, unleashed a state of emergency, police and military operations that show hundreds of homes of indigenous landowners surrounding the open pit mine raised to ground. The increased global power and influence of transnational companies like the Canadian Barrick Gold, managers of the program mine that they, alongside the PNG government, must be responsible for upholding human rights within the spires of influence. Corporations are also a threat to our environment. These mines pollute vital river sources and require an immense amount of energy to run. The Pogora mine alone produces over 400,000 tons of greenhouse gas and consumes over 7 billion gallons of water a year, which continually dumps pollutes into an 800-kilometer-long river system, eventually leading to the Gulf of Papua and reaching the Great Barrier Reef. In time of impending climate change, this environmental devastation affects us all. My recommendations, Madam Chair. I urge the Permanent Forum to establish a regular agenda point on the issue of the private sector and to write urgently to the government of Papua New Guinea and Barrick Gold Corporation of Canada, appealing for an urgent halt to the state of emergency and destruction of people's homes, and those the recommendations put forward in the report of the expert group meeting on extractive industries, indigenous people's rights, and corporate social responsibility, which met in Manila 2009, Philippines, and follow up by sending the findings to corporations, including Barrick Gold. We recommend that the World Bank have an in-depth interaction with the forum.
Brother, can you slow down just a little bit?
Okay.
For the
We recommend that the World Bank in-depth interaction with the forum next year so we can call for activation of the World Bank 2005 Extractive Industries review and for activation of the previous promises to address the impact and legacy of extractive industries on indigenous lands, territories, and natural resources. We ask the forum to investigate how to set up an indigenous arbitration system, a regulatory regime to control the practices of the transnational mining companies, other extractive industries, forestry, and fisheries. And we ask the forum to evaluate the amount different indigenous communities involuntarily subsidize the mining industries and other extractive industries through their natural resources, which are seized with minimal compensation, if any, by forms of colonialization and perpetrated by transnational companies. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much for your remarks and for staying within the time limit. We do appreciate your bringing your concerns to this forum. Thank you, sir. The next speaker on the list is The gentleman is Dario Rodriguez from the Indigenous World Association, who I called on earlier. Are you in the room, sir? No, then I will go to the next speaker. And we are doing the human rights agenda. May I remind you once again? Gulnara Abbasova, and that would be Tribal Link Foundation, Tamayana Foundation for Research and Support of Indigenous Peoples of Crimea. Madam, you have the floor.
With the Indigenous peoples representing Africa, Asia, Central and Eastern Europe, Russian Federation, Central Asia and Transcaucasia, Central and South America and Caribbean, North America and Pacific, participating in the Project Access Global Capacity Training, have expressed our concerns about the implementation of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, as called for by Article 42 of the Declaration. We recognize the progress on implementation of Article 42 in specific instances. For example, we welcome the position of the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination regarding implementation of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples through its recommendation to the United States of America in 2008 to use the Declaration as a guide to interpret the state parties' obligations under the Convention regarding the Indigenous Peoples. We also express our appreciation to the government of Bolivia on the implementation of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as national law, and we encourage other states to follow their example. However, Indigenous peoples are still being ignored and in many cases continue to lack recognition as Indigenous peoples by the countries in which they live, which creates serious impediment to the implementation of the Declaration. We express our concerns for Indigenous peoples who continue to suffer lack of recognition for their rights, political status, and very existence and identity as Indigenous peoples. Many states fail to even recognize the existence of Indigenous peoples in their borders. In this regard, we express particular concern for the situation of Ogiak people and Amazigh people in Africa, the Taino people in the Caribbean, Alifuru people and people of Rapa Nui in the Pacific, and Mitai Indigenous people in Asia, as well as Crimean Tatar people in Eastern Europe. We therefore urge the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues to recommend to the Economic and Social Council to call upon the state governments to implement the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and to recognize their original inhabitants as Indigenous peoples with full rights, including the right to self-determination, as upheld by the before-mentioned Declaration in Articles 3, 9, 33, and 37. We urge and encourage the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues to take steps to ensure capacity building for Indigenous leaders and communities to inform them on the rights affirmed in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We call upon the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in its 8th session to recommend a workshop on decolonization and its specific impact on Indigenous peoples under colonial domination. We further recommend that the UN Permanent Forum includes this critical issue in the discussion on the implementation of Article 3 of the Declaration and its 9th session in 2010. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam, for keeping within the time limit and also for your excellent remarks. Thank you so much. The next speaker on the list is Guido Quintero Mailman from the Center of Pueblo Mapuche
Pelanzaro.
I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, brothers and sisters. I'm a descendant of the first Mapuche fighters who gave their life to protect Mother Nature and to keep Mapuche territory. Today, I am here representing the autonomous Mapuche nation. Brothers and sisters present at this United Nations meeting, my Mapuche people is here to denounce that human rights are not observed in our territory. They are violated every day. In the Mapuche land, there is arbitrary detention, harassment of our leaders, mistreatment of children, women, and elders in our community by the Chilean state. The so-called democratic government of President Michelle Bachelet had committed itself to not applying counterterrorism laws. Today, the Chilean state has not heeded its word. We reiterate, Madam Chair, brothers and sisters, that Mapuches are not terrorists. We are committed to preserving our Mother Earth and our nature, our animals, native forests, traditional medicine, ceremonies, cemeteries, and sacred places, which are being overwhelmed without any consideration by transnational corporations in complicity with the government of Chile. We also ask for respect for our human and indigenous rights. International parliaments and treaties, which our forebears subscribed with the Crown of Spain and lately by the and after that by the Chilean state, reaffirm that the sovereignty of the territories south of the Biobío River. Mapuche and its land is a whole. We are the people of the earth. If you take the earth away from us, you take away our lives. We call for the immediate amendment of the laws on water in Mapuche territory. Water is not tradable. It is a vital element. It is a human right, a universal right, a right to life of all human beings. It is unprecedented for the Chilean state to artificially promote a campaign to cleanse its indigenous laws. The ratification of Convention 169 of ILO shows that there is a paternalistic spirit, and it masks the nation as if we did not exist as a culture. In other words, we are faced with a second colonization. We're not interested in participating in the institutional structure of a Chilean state in which we will always be a minority. We have been in existence for over 14,000 years. We maintain our Longco, our spiritual leaders, Machi, our healers, Kimche, our wise people. The Mapuche traditional structure is invisible in the eyes of the Western world. We do not need their recognition in papers we do not understand. We claim our right to participate at future assemblies and permanent forums of the United Nations with our own passport from the Mapuche nation. It is an offense for us to be identified as part of the Chilean state. Brothers and sisters, we are not Chilean, nor do we belong to the Chilean nation. We belong to the Mapuche nation. We value the Universal Declaration on Indigenous Peoples of the United Nations, which embodies the human rights of Indigenous people, such as the right to self-determination. We are grateful for the work done by the former and present Rapporteur of the United Nations, Mr. Rodolfo Stavenhagen and James Anaya, respectively, who have recommended to the government of Chile to respond to the legitimate claims of the Mapuche people. Thank you.
I would like to thank warmly the representative from the autonomous Mapuche Nation for his excellent remarks. Thank you. Thank you so much. And the next speaker on the list is Jamie Kurtz, and after that, Madame Celeste McKay will speak. So, Madame Janie Kurtz, are you in the room? She is representing the National Indigenous Youth Movement of Australia. Madam, you have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. The Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Organisations of Australia would like to acknowledge the work of the Permanent Forum for your continued expertise and leadership in promoting awareness about the human rights situation facing Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Through the adoption of the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People by the General Assembly, we now have an international framework that directly relates to the overall advancement of our rights, interests and aspirations. The Declaration adds substantive value to the intellectual infrastructure required to promote awareness and advance the exercise and enjoyment of human rights by Indigenous peoples and should be viewed as a crucial development in the history of the United Nations. The Australian Government's support of the Declaration marks an important transformation in the attitudes that have existed regarding the recognition of Indigenous Australians' collective rights. The Australian Government's support of the Declaration is a practical contribution to our domestic reconciliation process. We commend the Australian Government for their statement that the right of self-determination in Article 3 is to be applied consistently with its binding legal obligations in the ICCPR and the ICESCR. We note that in giving their support to the Declaration, the Government has stated that Australia's existing obligations under international human rights treaties are mirrored in the Declaration's fundamental principles. While supporting the Declaration is a positive initiative, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Organisations of Australia are concerned about the ambiguous nature of the Australian Government's support. In particular, we note that the Government's interpretation of free, prior and informed consent is inconsistent with existing international law. The recent establishment of a national consultative process for the potential development of a Charter of Human Rights in Australia is another positive initiative of the Australian Government. It is the position of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Peoples Organisation of Australia that a statutory charter of rights needs to be established and must annex all international human rights instruments that have been signed onto, including the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. While there is no certainty that a charter of rights will ever be adopted in Australia, the government should be applauded, creating a process through which its citizens can engage in a dialogue on this issue. The critical challenge now facing Indigenous peoples and the nation states in setting of the benchmarks, which can be used as a practical measurement on the extent of the enjoyment of the rights contained in the Declaration. This requires a commitment by and the collaboration of all actors in this debate, facilitated by the ongoing leadership that is provided, that is being provided by the Permanent Forum. Such benchmarks should not be seen by government simply as a means through which they can be criticised for not meeting their obligations. Benchmarks can and should be seen as adding value to development and implementation of future government policy. An important first step in the implementation of the Declaration at both the international and domestic level will require consideration of how to achieve best practice in the way UN agencies and government agencies, governments engage with Indigenous peoples. If engagement is simply used by UN agencies and governments as a modern-day euphemism for consultation with Indigenous peoples, it is difficult to imagine that our respective relationships will improve. Indigenous peoples claim to have a collective right to self-determination. It is not simply about taking a belligerent stand against governments for the invasion and colonisation of their lands and territories. It is based on our understanding that we are best placed to make the decisions that affect our lives and future of our peoples. Madam Chairperson, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Organisations of Australia recommend that the Permanent Forum, with the support of the Interagency Support Group, undertake an international consultative process with Indigenous peoples on the proposed concept of diplomacy, that is, to consider ways in which instruments such as the Declaration can be used to develop more effective models of engagement with Indigenous peoples. We recommend also that the Permanent Forum supports a study to elaborate on Article 3 of the Declaration. And the third recommendation is that the Permanent Forum engages with the United Nations Development Program and the International Parliamentarians Union to elaborate on models to guide Indigenous peoples on exercise of our rights to develop under Article 23. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gertz, for your excellent recommendations, and it's always wonderful to hear from the youth. Madam Celeste McKay, you have the floor, speaking for the Native Women's Association of Canada.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We welcome this opportunity to comment on the vital theme of human rights from our experience in advocating for the rights of Indigenous women, their families and communities in Canada. Every state has the obligation to uphold and promote the human rights of Indigenous peoples. The Native Women's Association of Canada is concerned about the current example being set by the government in Canada. As we know, Canada is one of the world's wealthiest countries and enjoys a reputation as a champion of human rights. Yet our reality is that we continue to face an enormous gap in the protection and fulfillment of our human rights. This was accurately summarized by the Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous Peoples in the report of his 2004 mission to Canada, which sadly remains true today. Economic, social, and human indicators of well-being, quality of life, and development are consistently lower among Aboriginal people than other Canadians. Poverty, infant mortality, unemployment, morbidity, suicide, criminal detention, children on welfare, women victims of abuse, child prostitution, all are much higher among Aboriginal people than in any other sector of Canadian society, whereas educational attainment, health standards, housing conditions, family income, access to economic opportunity, and to social services are generally lower. This is only one example of many of international human rights bodies and mechanisms that have called on Canada to take effective actions to ensure that Indigenous peoples can enjoy the human rights to which we are all entitled. Another recent example is the many recommendations made by states at the Universal Periodic Review of Canada. Our organization has repetitively expressed concern over the government's failure to engage in a meaningful dialogue about how to respond to these recommendations. Far too often, instead of taking meaningful action to bring about the needed change, the government has relied on simply enumerating how it is already spending money on existing programs. This approach falls short of making a commitment to implement effective solutions resulting in substantive change. We are seeking a commitment from the Government of Canada to establish a different kind of relationship where Canada will work collaboratively with Indigenous peoples in Canada at every step of the decision-making process to narrow the gap in human rights protection and fulfillment. A cornerstone of such a relationship is support for the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The UN Declaration is a roadmap for working collaboratively to fulfill human rights that have been far too long denied. The UN Declaration is particularly important to Indigenous women who have suffered the consequences of multiple forms of discrimination as keepers of our traditions and culture. And an essential part of implementing the UN Declaration is ensuring a culturally relevant gender-based analysis of the benefits and impacts of all policies, programs, and laws that may affect our rights. Indigenous peoples and representative organizations, including Indigenous women's organizations, must be equal partners in this effort. This commitment to fulfilling Indigenous peoples' rights should be the hallmark of all aspects of government policy, including foreign trade and investment. For example, Canada has been actively pursuing closer trade relations with Colombia. We have been disappointed that Canada has not used its trade relations as an opportunity to press for effective protections for the Indigenous leaders and communities who face daily threats to their survival. We want to acknowledge the Special Rapporteur's continued commitment to follow up on its mission to Colombia to address the grave human rights violations facing Indigenous peoples there. In summary, we make the following recommendations to the Permanent Forum: to encourage all states without exception to endorse and implement the UN Declaration as a universal minimum standard to the protection and fulfillment of the human rights of Indigenous peoples, to encourage all states to collaborate with Indigenous peoples and representative organizations, particularly Indigenous women's organizations, in the development and application of culturally relevant gender-based analysis tools, to call on the Special Rapporteur to encourage the Government of Canada to report on any measures taken specifically to implement the recommendations contained in the report to the 2004 mission to Canada, and finally, to encourage all states to develop open and transparent mechanisms in collaboration with Indigenous peoples to consider and report on treaty monitoring bodies, special mechanisms, and the Universal Periodic Review and the Expert Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples so that such recommendations are duly considered and result in real change to the lives of Indigenous women, their families, and their nations. Thank you.
I would like to thank the representative of the Native Women's Association of Canada for her excellent recommendations.
Thank you, Madam McKay. The next speakers on the list are Arete Tave from the Indigenous World Association. After that, Malia Nobraga. I hope you're in the room. And also Lori Johnston. So I am going to call on Arete Tave from the Indigenous World Association. Are you in the room? No. Malia Nobraga from the Center for Hawaiian Studies. From the Center of Hawaiian Studies. An Indigenous World Association? No. Lori Johnston from the... Lori, very good. Push the button. Madam, you have the floor. Push your button, please. Thank you.
Thank you for hearing from Southeast Indigenous peoples on future work for the forum. We were assigned by our Creator to care for the land in which we were discovered by colonial powers. If we are to survive the climate crisis, we must respect our Creator's wisdom and allow Indigenous peoples to...
Excuse me, Madam. You may not have heard the instructions, but Ms. Johnson, we are doing the human rights agenda item.
Oh, I have that too.
Oh. We like your tenacity. So we will give you a second. Agenda item, and you are on the list. So it's the human rights agenda item. We reopened the speakers list for human rights, so you have the floor.
Okay. We are Yamasi people, and we are under U.S. attack because of our political identity as Indigenous title holders of land roughly between Daytona and Charleston and in the fall between Orlando and Augusta. We request a ceasefire so that we can discuss the U.S. method of warfare. Europeans say they came here because God led them to a place they could practice their religion. European religion had standards for warfare which were violated in years past. These standards continue to be violated. We ask in the name of the one that created the waters, the winds, and the lands, and all the people in it, that the U.S. stop attacking Yamasi elders, women, and children. We were not defeated. We did not surrender. The U.S. just moved in, and we finally refrained from using violence to defend ourselves from colonial violence. We prayed and attempted to engage in peace talks as we continued to care for our people, land, and culture as best we can with few resources. We pray and continue to try to engage the U.S. in peace talks. In this millennium, Yamasi from ages of 8 days to 88 years have been stalked, harassed, spied on, and engaged in fraudulent relationships in church, school, work, and neighborhoods. While we go without food, housing, health care, and education, Yamasi have suffered from assault, arson, abduction, imprisonment, drugging, brainwashing, rape, and other crimes. The U.S. has terrorized our culture bearers into silence as we try to protect our young from U.S. identification. The U.S. has sabotaged our efforts to get land, food, education, health care, housing, employment, and other benefits of the U.S. economy after destroying our native economy. Consequently, our people are economically enslaved to the agents of U.S. force that have attacked us for more than a century. The U.S. method of waging war by imprisoning Yamasi on fabricated charges to ease U.S. access to Yamasi women in order to violate our reproductive rights sets a dangerous precedent for international relations. The U.S. ignores our leaders' steadfast refusal to give up our ancestral lands, waters, and winds. Instead of negotiating an agreement for joint use in government, the U.S. kidnaps our teenage girls, rapes, and impregnates us in order to gain control of children that it can raise in colonial culture. The U.S. records these children as federalized indigenous peoples without their informed consent and in an attempt to negate our Aboriginal rights. Raping an Indigenous nation into U.S. submission violates all standards of Christian warfare and U.N. conventions, and we request that this practice be denounced by the U.N. and the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Commodification of Indigenous peoples, who are humans created for a special purpose, undermines all that colonial governments claim to represent. You cannot enslave the people that our Creator assigned to care for the land and succeed in reordering the Creator's world. This is the way it is. Our Creator put us here to preserve the land. If you want to live with the land, you have to live with us. If you destroy us, you destroy the land that we were created to steward. We invite the U.S. to release our captives and stop recording Yamasi and other Southeast Indigenous people as federalized Indigenous people without our informed consent. We all face the dangers of climate change. Now, more than ever, the U.S. has reason to stop waging this war of aggression against Yamasi and work with us to protect the world for all peoples. We call on the Permanent Forum to denounce rape and other colonial war crimes against Yamasi and any other Indigenous peoples. We ask the Permanent Forum to carry to the U.S. this invitation for peace and an end to violence. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Johnston. The next speaker on the list is, and you'll have to bear with me, Hanabatu Togonchok from the Southern Mongolian Human Rights Information Center. Are you in the room? Oh, excellent. And after that is our dear friend Joji. Joji, I know you're in the room. And after that, Eleanor Dickton from the Asian Indigenous Women's Caucus. I'm giving you a heads up, just in case you're not in the room, someone will go find you. All right, so from the Southern Mongolian Human Rights Information Center, sir, you have the floor. You have the floor, madam. Thank
you. Madam Chair, I was asked by our brother to read the statement in English. May I? Thank you.
Of course.
Madam Chairperson, distinguished Permanent Forum members, and distinguished Indigenous Peoples representatives. My name is, please forgive me, Dikis Bayar, and I represent Indigenous Mongolian people in China, home to 5 million Indigenous Mongolian people. Southern Mongolia, widely known as Inner Mongolia, was officially incorporated into the People's Republic of China in 1949. During the 60-year period, the Chinese government has carried out a series of state-sponsored massacres, heavy-handed political repression, large-scale population transfer, cultural assimilation, and near-total destruction of the natural environment of southern Mongolia. As a result of large-scale Chinese population transfer, today the Mongols constitute only 18% of the total population in the region. The natural grasslands where the Mongols maintained their nomadic way of life for thousands of years have been destroyed by unsound mining operations and the non-sustainable farming practices of millions of Chinese immigrants. In order to cover up the ecological destruction and to justify their population transfer policy, the Chinese authorities have started blaming on the indigenous Mongolian herders, claiming that the ecological degradation is caused by the indigenous Mongolian primitive and backward nomadic way of life, despite the fact that the true cause of the ecological destruction of my homeland is the non-sustainable farming practice of 12 million Chinese peasants who are cultivating my land every spring. Madam Chair, Mongolian people have maintained their traditional nomadic way of life for thousands of years in a perfect harmony with the natural environment. Now, under the Chinese government's so-called ecological migration and livestock grazing prohibition laws, grazing livestock on grassland is considered as an illegal act. The Chinese government recently set up a specific task force called Livestock Prohibition Team that has authorized the right to confiscate Mongolian herders' livestock grazing on grassland and given the right to arrest, detain, torture the livestock herders and issue tickets to livestock herders. Herds of livestock are confiscated and hundreds of herders have been detained and beaten up by the task force personnel on a daily basis for grazing their livestock on their grazing lands. In addition to these egregious policies, mining, or the so-called opening up, is another problem threatening our community and our natural environment. Hundreds of Chinese and foreign mining companies are rushing into our ancestral land and opening up mines under the Chinese policies of so-called Western development and Western energy to East. Madam Chair, China has recently declared that Inner Mongolia, with its rich oil, gas, coal, and other minerals, has become the energy base of China. Behind this arrogant statement, what is going on is that the indigenous Mongolian people have been displaced from their ancestral land without free, prior, and informed consent. Their sacred places have been opened up, and toxic industrial wastes have been dumped on their grazing lands. Madam Chair, China has signed the United Nations Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples without considering her 55 indigenous peoples as indigenous. As you all know, China is not a country of rule of law, and the government of China has continually ignored its citizens' basic human rights and fundamental freedoms that are guaranteed by both the Chinese constitutions and the Universal Human Rights Declaration. Given these circumstances, my question to the Permanent Forum is, what mechanism does the Permanent Forum have to ensure that China respects and protects the rights of indigenous peoples within her borders? Thank you.
We would like to thank Mr. Togochog for his remarks, and please extend that to him in his language. The government of China would like to make a remark. That is their right to reply at the end of the session. Thank you. Thank you very much, Your Excellency. We will continue with our speakers list. And the next speaker on the list is Madam Joji Carino. Madam Carino, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. I wish to draw the attention of the UN Permanent Forum to the plight of indigenous peoples whose ancestral lands have been transformed into cities or urban areas, and in particular my people, the Ibaloy, in Baguio City, Philippines. This year marks 100 years since the transformation of our native lands into Baguio City, into a hill station of the colonial American government. 1 mile radius from the Ibaloy chieftain Mateo Carino's house was expropriated to form the city center, while his pasture lands were transformed into John Hay Air Base and Recreation Center. Vast tracts of lands were declared as government reservations, and rapid urbanization displaced the Ibaloy from our ancestral lands and opened the gates for migrant settlers. Today, the Ibaloy are a marginalized minority in Baguio City, and the case of the Ibaloy people of Baguio is internationally significant. Mateo Carino, my great-grandfather, asserted his ownership over the land taken by the American colonial administration and filed a case that reached the United States Supreme Court. And in a landmark decision penned by Oliver Wendell Holmes, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that whatever may have been the technical position of Spain, it does not follow that in the view of the United States, he had lost all rights and was a mere trespasser when the present government seized his lands. The argument to that effect seems to amount to a denial of native titles throughout an important part of the island of Luzon. And it concludes, when as far back as testimony or memory goes, that land has been held by individuals under a claim of private ownership, it will be presumed to have been held in the same way from before the Spanish conquest and has never been public land. The Carreño decision on native title established a legal doctrine of legal title, which is in fact the foundation of the Philippine Indigenous People's Rights Act, passed into law in 1997. The law recognizes ancestral domain or ownership of land established through collective memory and custom law, and that for indigenous peoples, land ownership is not given by formal titles, but is claimed by use and inheritance since time immemorial. Sadly, in Baguio City itself, the Carreño Doctrine has never been implemented. Camp Janhay Recreation Base is in the hands of private developers, while many Ibaloy lands remain classified as government reservations. Worse, there are conspicuous irregularities and anomalies in the processing of ancestral land and domain claims by the National Commission on Indigenous Peoples in the Philippines. One clear example is the recent issuance by the NCIP of a certificate of ancestral land title over 69 hectares lot in Baguio City to bogus claimants over the long-standing claim of the Carreño family. This act of the NCIP is a shame and grave injustice to the Ibaloy of Baguio, a sacrilege to the memory of Mateo Carreño and the legal doctrine of native title. This usurpation of lands through legal manipulation makes a mockery of the Indigenous Peoples' Rights Act and the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. On behalf of the Ibaloy of Baguio City, we have appealed to the Special Rapporteur on the Fundamental Rights and Freedoms of Indigenous Peoples, Attorney James Anaya, to look into this serious violation of human rights by the very government agency assigned to protect us, as a follow-up to the earlier visit of Mr. Rudolfo Stavenhagen, who gave cognizance of the special situation of urban indigenous peoples in the Philippines. We have asked the UN Special Rapporteur to investigate and recommend corrective measures to uphold the rights of the indigenous Ibaloy people, and we direct the same appeal to the Philippine members of this august body, and of course, to the entire UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you very much, Joji, for your comments and recommendations. The permanent forum members have asked, one of our permanent forum members have asked to speak, and our time is getting very short, but I'm going to call on my colleague, Eugenio. So, Eugenio, please take the floor, and could you keep your remarks to the point? Thank you so much, sir.
Madam Chair, I am very saddened that a purely private matter be brought before the United Nations, faced with problems of global proportions such as genocide and climate change. The matter brought before this forum is a purely private case involving two clans fighting over a piece of land. That land, the speaker, belonged to a clan which lost before the National Commission on Indigenous Peoples. But I would like to emphasize that the clan who won is also an indigenous, composed of indigenous peoples who claim native title over the land. The action of the National Commission on Indigenous Peoples was based on the evidence where both parties were required to submit evidence and, of course, the law which over which they claim that they have right over the property. The National Commission on Indigenous Peoples decision, although I was not present then, was made by the Commission as a collegial body, and after going over the recommendations of the legal department over the documents submitted by the parties, found for the other clan. Now, the speaker does not have a special power of attorney to raise the question because she belongs to a clan, and other members of the clan question the wisdom of bringing the matter before the United Nations. This is because under our laws, they can appeal it to the Court of Appeals or even bring the matter before the administrative bodies. As a matter of fact, the lawyers brought the matter to the Court of Appeals, where it is now pending. The speaker, not satisfied, brought the matter to the special rapporteur, Mr. Anaya. But like I said, just because you invoke the Carreño Doctrine doesn't mean that you are entitled to that piece of land, because the other side is also invoking native title as evidence or to support its claim over the property. I would like to stress that the decision of the commission was based on the evidence and of the law on the case. I would like also to state that I have been a lawyer for 30 years, and after going over also the decision of the commission, I agree and I support the decision of the commission. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to my colleague, Eugenio of the Permanent Forum. I would like to give the floor to the distinguished representative of China and for his right of reply. And if I may respectfully remind the distinguished representative that his right of reply stay within the 3-minute response, if I may, Mr. Representative. Thank you so much. You have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So far, the work of the permanent forum has been quite successful. And I'm convinced that this meeting will be crowned with the success and the positive results. Just now, a so-called representative of a human rights organization from southern Mongolia made some attacks on our policy of my government in Inner Mongolia. What he said was totally far away from the reality and the facts, in total ignorance of the achievements that the Chinese government has achieved in our ethnic minority areas. It attacks also without any evidence, without any foundation, the policy of the Chinese government towards our ethnic minority groups. This is actually a challenge, a serious challenge to the sovereignty of our nation and also our policy. This is why I strongly demand that permanent forum in the future should be more careful in screening organizations in participating in our discussion, so that member countries, member states' sovereignty and integrity of a territory will not be encroached. China is a unified and a multi-ethnic country, which includes we have Chinese Han nationality and Mongolian, all in total account to around 50 nationalities or ethnic minority groups. There are also they are all native indigenous people in our homeland. They are all equal, and their legitimate interests and rights are equally guaranteed by the country. We value the social and economic development of our regions dominated by ethnic minorities. We protect their identity in terms of their cultural, religious, and social features. We guarantee their participation in our political, health, social, and education work. We are committed to protect according to our constitution and our laws and autonomous regions, to adopt more special preferential measures towards them, to encourage the poverty alleviation and social and economic development in regions of ethnic minorities. We are committed to work together, to working together to build a prosperous and strong, democratic and civilized and harmonious nation. I thank you, Madam Chair.
I would like to thank warmly the distinguished representative of China for his remarks, and to also thank his government for the support of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and to remind the delegates that this afternoon we will be returning to agenda item 7, the future work of the Permanent Forum. And we also have some announcements that will be made by our distinguished secretary. Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is a meeting with the representative of the United States of America and Native American delegations at 1 p.m. in small conference room, alphabet room B. States, members, and specialized agencies who want to inscribe on the list of speakers for tomorrow's item 8, which is draft agenda for the 9th session, can do that behind me here with Lady Ms. Comatina. She is ready to take inscriptions. And the final announcement, the Commonwealth Secretariat would like to meet IP women from Commonwealth countries in this room for 15 minutes right after this meeting is over. Thank you.
The meeting is adjourned until 3 o'clock.
Siddiqui, Toronto.
I'm not going to stay on. I'm just going to stay for a while.
I cannot stay on for
okay.
I'll be there on the 31st. You?
I go on the Saturday. Is that the 30th?
That's the 30th. And then you will be there on the 31st. Where are you staying?
Sorry?
Where are you staying?
Good afternoon, everyone. My name's Sam Johnston. I'm from the United Nations University, and I'm a senior research fellow there. And today I'm moderating or facilitating the side event, and we're going to hear about the UN RED program. I want to get through the presentations as quickly as possible so that we've got time for comments and discussion. Rather than sort of open up with a long statement, I think I'll just introduce the speakers very quickly and briefly what they're going to speak about, and then I'll turn to the first speaker. And we're going to start off today. We're going to hear from Tim Clares, the Environment Finance Advisor of the UN RED Program, and he's going to talk briefly about the UN RED Program, its background, where we are so far with its overall development in the sense of the entire program. Then we're going to hear from Vicky Torlia-Corpez, who's going to talk to us about the risks and opportunities of the RED program. And then we're going to hear from Elspeth Halverson, the program analyst from the UN RED program, and she's going to talk about engagement of Indigenous people specifically and talk about these operational guidelines and explain their background, where are we with their development and how far have they been applied so far. And finally, we're going to end up with Mina Setra, who is the observer for the Asia and Pacific Regions and Policy Board of the UN RED program. Oh, sorry. My apology, Asia only. And she's also going to talk about some of the opportunities and the challenges that are facing Indigenous people and properly engaging in this program. So thank you very much. And Tim, I give you the floor.
Thank you very much, Sam. Thank you, everyone, for coming this afternoon. We really appreciate it. We know that it's been very busy agenda for you all, and we appreciate your perseverance in staying with this side event with so much on the agenda. And I'm also very excited to be here. I've been working with the UN RED program over the last year, based here with UNDP here in New York, and I've been working mainly on supporting the national programs and haven't really had a chance to engage with such a group and in such a forum as this, as my other colleagues have had. So I'm very excited. It's great to be able to join such a group of stakeholders who we recognise have such an important role in the implementation of RED. Some of you may be aware of the ongoing discussions and involvement that you've had more than I am with the UN RED program, but I'm glad to be part of it from today. I'm going to try and keep this very simple, very brief. Many of you are probably already familiar with RED, so this is just a very quick slide to ensure we understand what the acronym means that we're talking about, and to differentiate it, the RED as the issue that's being discussed in the UNFCCC negotiations, to the UN RED program. Sometimes there is some confusion. The UN RED program being a collaborative partnership between three UN agencies, FAO, UNDP, and UNEP, and it's a contribution to the RED and efforts to develop an international financial mechanism that can provide incentives for reducing greenhouse gas emissions associated with deforestation and degradation. How will it work? Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I'm not going to be able to give the answer here. This is the question a lot of us are asking. It's one of the main challenges that the UN RED program is engaged on, and obviously one of the important reasons why we want to continue the dialogue with Indigenous peoples' representatives and other forest-dependent community stakeholders, because this group, as much as any, will have to have an important say in determining how RED will work, and we very much recognise that. The only point I really want to make is that, from our perspective, part of the deal, if you like, that's hopefully going to be negotiated under the UNFCCC negotiations in Copenhagen is an effort to support developing countries move to low-carbon development trajectories. So we very much see this as a sustainable development deal as much as a climate change deal. And RED will have to play a significant role, in our view, in supporting those shifts and supporting countries be able to use their forest resources in a way that supports that shift to low-carbon sustainable development. And that's the way we're approaching the RED issue. If some of you were at the side event yesterday that the FCPF and of the World Bank, the Forest Carbon Partnership Facility of the World Bank had yesterday, you may recognise this slide, and happy to acknowledge one of our colleagues from the FCPF here, Hattie, who was also part of the site event yesterday. And the point I want to make here is the same one I think that was made yesterday, that there are a number of phases or elements that will happen along a continuum to ensure that a international red mechanism can work and developing countries are able to participate and all stakeholders benefit from such a mechanism. And really, while there will be the need for large-scale capacity building and investments that will lead to hopefully some reduced emissions and other benefits, what we're talking about at this stage is really just the first phase of readiness. And the UN Red Program at the moment is focusing on the readiness phase, and the small introduction I'm giving here is really talking about the efforts and contributions that can be made to ensure that countries are ready for RED, ready for a RED mechanism, have the capacities in place to participate in the subsequent phases. And that's commonly referred to as readiness, RED readiness. There's obviously quite a number of complex elements to be considered in assisting national readiness. And here is just a very simplistic diagram of some of those elements. Obviously, countries need to be in a position to manage the readiness process and take that through to the other phases of a national RED process. Here we're talking about the sort of inter-stakeholder coordination mechanisms that can ensure that provide a framework for inputs.